From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a deal decades in the making to level the playing fields in Michigan schools.
It's been referred to within the Lansing circle as the 2X formula, that if we're going to increase schools at the top by, say, $100, we're going to increase schools at the bottom by $200.
We'll find out what's in the proposed education budget. Then, what it means for openly gay Michiganders to stand at the front of a classroom.
It was 30 years in the classroom before students asked me if I was married, and I bravely said we had just legally been married. And I said, yes, I have a wife.
And Detroit artist Syra Dardis talks about meditative geometry and how she helps others address trauma with art.
Creativity is a part of healing, as it can be a huge tool for healing.
Those stories coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, two teachers will talk to us about helping LGBT kids in the classroom and their own struggles for acceptance at work. That's ahead in the second half of the show. But first, we wanted to take a look inside the education budget that Michigan's two legislative bodies have agreed on. Governor Whitmer is expected to put her signature on it shortly. Now, today, the governor moved on a supplemental spending bill that puts federal money to work for K through 12 education. But the legislature recently finished work on the state education budget, and that's what we're going to talk about now. It includes some things you should know about. It's a $17 billion package and hits a major goal that's been discussed for years in Lansing. So with us now to survey this is Brian Gutman. He's director of external relations for Education Trust Midwest and has had his finger on the pulse throughout budget negotiations. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
For starters, just a quick caveat. Governor Whitmer may, of course, opt to strike out some aspects of this bill using veto power, but we just wanted to go through some of the major features that are of interest. This big milestone that's in the bill regarding per-pupil funding, can you explain why per-pupil spending has been such a hot topic over the years?
Sure. Well, it is a big milestone. It doesn't mean that our work is done, but it's been a goal of the Michigan legislature and policymakers since the early 90s when they passed Proposal A. And the idea was to shift from a school funding structure mostly based on property taxes to one mostly based on sales taxes, and to significantly reduce the gap and now eliminate the gap between school districts on a per pupil basis. So under this budget, for the first time, students across the state would be funded at the same common level, $8,700 per student. And that is both an increase across all students. It's also now decades in the making of, again, going from a place where the wealth of a local community, the taxation rates really determined how well the local school system was supported, to one where all school systems across the state have that common baseline. It is really important to note, though, that we also know that students have different needs when they walk in the classroom door. And so while we've eliminated the gap between school districts and schools, we haven't yet addressed that significant gap that exists in making sure that we're also funding based on every student's individual need.
Can you cast some light on the backstory about why this took so long to fix?
You know, there was a massive gap back when this was first attempted and passed in 1994. And the way that the state has gone about fixing this is to say, we're going to every year increase our overall funding level for schools, but we're going to double that investment for schools that are funded less at a lower rate than others. So it's been referred to within the Lansing circle as the 2X formula, that if we're going to increase schools at the top by, say, $100, we're going to increase schools at the bottom by $200. That just makes for really incremental progress. I also have to say that over the past many years, we've also seen lots of revisits to the tax code. And so when we go back in and we exempt a group of services or goods from sales tax, or we reduce it, even if it's for a really good purpose, that also means that there's less money coming in for K-12 education. And there are estimates that are exceedingly high about how much money has been not entered into our system in the first place because we've chosen to give tax breaks or redirect funding elsewhere within the state budget from education.
So what does this change make possible over the long term, that $8,700 per pupil? I mean, we can talk a little bit further about other things that need to be done, but how does that leave our school districts with respect to a basic budget year?
Sure. So every school district has their own spending priorities, and this $8,700 per pupil will meet the needs of some districts, frankly, better than others. It does still, again, leave these gaps based on student needs. So, for example, if you're a high poverty district, we're still not providing sufficient additional resources on top of that $8,700 to make sure that you have the resources and staffing and supports to make sure that low-income students have the same access to opportunity and achievement and the supports that they need to succeed compared to their higher income pupil. We still have an underfunded special education system where we need to make sure that we're meeting the needs of each one of these students and frankly lack the resources at scale to do so. This budget does, I think it's worth noting, make some important investments in special education, particularly for really, really young children, 0 to 3 through the early on program.
That is something I wanted to ask you about. The budget expands an early childhood program called Great Start Readiness. Can you explain what it is and how it's different from Head Start?
Sure. So Great Start Readiness is a state preschool program that looks to make sure that every child, regardless of income, has access to a quality early learning opportunity. And it's virtually universal for 4-year-olds and has significant access for 3-year-olds. One thing that's important to note in this budget is that the additional investment, $168.5 million that's going to that program, is not focused at expanding the number of seats. It's not going to make a previously ineligible child now eligible. What it's going to do is it's going to bring up the amount per pupil that we're spending for a full-time early childhood student to the same level that we spend in the K-12 system, $8,700. And that's important because historically, we've treated 4-year-olds very differently than 5-year-olds, when in reality, we want to make sure that every child who's going through this system is well-equipped to enter kindergarten and well-supported to learn once they're there. Head Start is a federal program that focuses similarly on low-income students in that early childhood area before they enter kindergarten, similarly trying to make sure that a family's income doesn't determine whether a child is entering kindergarten prepared to learn at a kindergarten level or not.
The K through 12 budget also includes $75 million in federal cash for heating and air conditioning improvements, HVAC systems. Was that added with COVID and air quality in mind?
That was added with, I believe, a couple of things in mind, although it is certainly hard to read intentions through budget language. That $70 million is for capital HVAC infrastructure, but it's focused on schools that have a year-round calendar, or sometimes referred to a balanced calendar. So that is both considering the air quality needs that have become so much more heightened under COVID, as well as making sure that if a school is planning to serve students throughout the summer, that there are also resources for them to either improve or install air conditioning so that that building can be comfortable during the summer.
You know, I did wonder if that was also a nod to the fact that many schools will be needing to do year-round things. Brian, we're in a time when a lot of things got pushed on the back burner because of COVID, and there are a lot of educators and families talking about remedial education needs. When you look at the whole of this budget, do you see it addressing the things that happened and the things that we didn't do for our kids this year?
This budget has the seeds in place for that to happen, but it's really going to come down to quality implementation and the targeting of resources to the communities with the greatest need. So there is plenty of opportunity through this budget, for example, to make sure that we use research-based practices, high-intensity tutoring, extended learning time, whether that's through summer learning or weekend learning or break learning or restructuring of the school day itself. and other sorts of intensive and wraparound supports. There are bits and pieces scattered throughout this budget. For example, making sure that schools have greater support for hiring psychologists and social workers, nurses and counselors, for providing those sorts of services, attendance recovery services, and then really importantly, benchmark assessments, which are quick, multi-point assessments taken throughout the year to monitor student learning. All of these are really important pieces, but two important notes. One, it's going to come down to quality implementation for students who truly need it the most. And two, this has to be a down payment. Budgets are primarily about 1 year in the state of Michigan. And if we take a look at this next year as a COVID recovery year, and then the following year move on, we're really missing the boat. There were tremendous learning needs, particularly for vulnerable and underserved students pre-COVID. COVID exacerbated them. Many services weren't provided because of the pandemic. And we have seen a huge increase in the amount of unfinished learning. We really need to be starting in earnest right now this summer in making sure that students who have unfinished learning that was because of the pandemic or existed beforehand, that they have the services that they need to be able to catch up and to really get back on track quickly. That's going to be a multi-year investment, and this is just the start.
So about that, this was the only part of the overall state budget that lawmakers have been able to agree on so far, just this K-12 money. And we should say there's a flood of cash in Lansing at the moment because of federal COVID recovery spending and a couple of other aspects. When you think about the long game, do you see agreement among legislators on how to have the school funding and school equity conversation going forward?
Time will certainly tell on that. Federal funding and increased tax collections have provided, certainly within the education space, an exceptional opportunity to jumpstart funding equity in Michigan. We really need to look at this budget, though, as a down payment and now pivot and focus on our future revenue, on prioritizing funding based on student need. This can be a start, it can't be an end. And these federal dollars will run out. And I think right now, it's incumbent that legislators and community leaders and parents and school leaders are thinking about what happens in two school years when we don't have this influx of federal funding. And how do we make the most of this moment? Make sure that when we're spending federal dollars now, they're on systemic improvements to the greatest extent possible, so that when those dollars are gone, we have something that remains.
Brian Gutman of Education Trust Midwest. Brian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we're going to meet an artist who works with young people both in schools and out of them. Detroit's Syra Dardis talks to us about her practice and helping others with theirs in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Detroit artist Syra Dardis has a portfolio of ink, watercolors, print media, cut paper, photography, and much more. But it could be said that a portion of her practice is people. An educator and an organizer, Dardis works with kids in schools, teaching them to unlock their ideas and give them form. And in less formal settings, she shows them ways to be who they are without fear. She and her partner, the artist Backpack Durden, have created an organization called Paper Street Publishing that's been active all throughout the pandemic year, helping people unlock their creativity and their identities. Does Syra Dardis ever sleep? We're going to find out today. She joins us now. Syra Dardis, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a good question. Do I sleep?
Well, I'm guessing not much lately. I mean, Detroit's recovering from some pretty major flooding. Are you and yours okay?
We are okay. We are definitely in the thick of it, though. My partner and I live on the east side of Detroit, and I know that there's a lot of areas in the city that have been deeply affected, but definitely folks over here have been deeply affected by the flooding, and we are amongst them. So.
Yeah. There's so many artists who use the basement space as a creative area or storage for their work. Mm-hmm. And I just, my heart goes out to them right now. I know that you had a somewhat non-traditional education experience as you were growing up. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I was homeschooled and partially unschooled until about 14, which, you know, like everything, had, I'm sure, a spectrum of impacts, both positive, negative, and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind saying like why your parents decided to go that road?
Yeah. To be honest, a couple of members of my family, I would describe, now we have language like neurodivergent to describe the way that we are. And I think that back then there wasn't so much language or like empathy or understanding. And instead of, you know, putting us in situations that challenge us not to be able to express ourselves, I think that they felt like they could just do that at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think part of that was out of shame and maybe some feeling like they needed to control something that felt uncontrollable. And then part of that, I think, was maybe a deep-seated understanding that people are just people, and the system that we use to educate people is generally not very conducive to nurturing the human spirit and learning.
Right. Well, how did having that experience of being homeschooled and partly unschooled, how did that inform the work that you do with kids right now?
It definitely deeply informed it, because I think I was able to explore and learn through that exploration and that play. And frankly, just being kind of left alone to navigate what drives me. And I try to embody that same energy when I'm working with young people. I try to not be prescriptive. I try to practice a lot of consent. I try to advocate for play. I think the biggest difference is that I was often very alone, and I didn't get to have the community that I think is so vital to learning. And so that is a portion that I tried to also wrap into working with young people, is how collaboration and community building and relationship building and trust building is so essential to learning.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things were you creating when you were a kid?
Actually, the beginning of my artistic career was very fiber-based. I was very interested in textiles, and I was very interested in sewing my own garments. I think a little bit because I wanted to wear very fashionable things that
right.
I was not allowed to wear.
Well, and if you can't buy it, you got to make it.
Yeah, and I'm also a very petite person, and I've always been very small. And so I was always like, well, you know, I want to wear clothes that I'm not supposed to wear, number one. Number two, and no one's buying them for me. And I don't have any money, so I'm going to make them. And then number two, like, they wouldn't have fit me anyway. So I'm just going to do the custom look.
Nice. Are there ways that spilled over into your adult creative life? I mean, I'm not exactly asking if you're still sewing, although I'm curious.
Yeah.
But just that agency of putting things into the world, how has that flowered in your adult life?
Oh, gosh. That's such a good question. I think, like, that is something that I've never heard reflected back that way, but it's so true. Like, I was really privileged in the way that I felt like I was able to create and birth things into the world. So, and I had that so readily. And I think some people don't get that early on. And so it feels a little more challenging. Like there's a block a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of my access to just like play and toying with things and bringing these things into the world, I don't have that block. And so I feel very creatively rich, brought me a lot of life-affirming joy.
Yeah. If you're just joining us today, my guest is artist Syra Dardis. Syra, you have a really visually stunning set of works that I wanted to ask you about, the Aban mm-hmm. series. And they're based on the geometry of classical Persian gardens. Mm-hmm. Do you want to describe them for folks who've never seen them before?
Sure, yeah. So They are works on paper. I make a lot of the pigments that I use to make the pieces on my own. And interestingly, tapestry from Iran is an abstracted version of an aerial view of a garden, a Persian garden construct. And those were constructed for the purpose of, plants growing. And they were reconstructed and looked at and thinking, and they were thought of in a way that basically that you could figure out through using sacred geometry, which exists inside of these plants. You can then use that same system outside of those plants to help facilitate those plants grow better together. And I thought that that was really, I think that that is very beautiful metaphorically when you're thinking about human structures and systems and frameworks, how you can take something intrinsically to yourself. How do I work best? How do I thrive best? How am I feeling seen, needed, valued, fed? And then use those same frameworks to then design a system for the collective to reach those same goals. And during the pandemic, I feel like there was so much of the opposite of that happening that I wanted to spend time meditating on that idea as a form of manifesting it into the world.
Yeah, I was curious. It's interesting you mentioned the meditative state. I wondered what kind of headspace you're in when you're making them. They're so intricate with that, gorgeous three-dimensional quality.
I think that art making is a very spiritual and intense practice, and I hold a lot of regard for it. I think it deserves a lot of care and a lot of consideration. And when I make those pieces, I try to get into that space, so I'll make sure that I'm ready to be there. I've worked with a lot of artists and they usually have things going on, but I love being completely silent, which backpack is always that's so bizarre. But I just being fully present and thoughtful. So I'm often silent because if I'm taking in other stimulus, I feel like I'm going to put that into the work.
Mm-hmm. You spent some time living in Guatemala. And you've also worked with youth in Southwest Detroit, but your family background is Persian. Mm-hmm. And these are part of two larger, more prominent communities within Detroit, which is a majority Black city. What was it like for you to carve out space as a queer person within those cultures?
I feel very held by the queer community here. I also feel like that is starkly different than how I felt with my family or how I felt in other places. So I felt not so much like I needed to carve, but that I was able to be, a part of. Whereas in some of the other places that I operate in, there is a lot of carving out that needs to be done. And I think that that's challenging work. And I'm not always really good at that kind of work. I really love being in Detroit and being amongst people who I don't have to,
it's not a carving process.
Yeah. It's like a welcoming, it's a hug, it's a hold, it's building, it's sharing ideas, it's sharing food. It's not like I need to, I don't like having to be hard. I don't want to have to be tough. I've been that person in my life, and it was when I was hurt, or when I was forced to be, and I would love to continue to be able to be radically soft and not carve things.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You have in some ways been out to students that you work with. I'm wondering what that looks like and how you see it having an effect on those kids.
Yeah. I try to practice wrapping that into all the other normal parts about engaging with other people in an academic space or a youth-led space or a youth-centered space. Like, I always make sure to introduce myself. I practice, you know, humanizing the experience of being an educator or facilitator so that they can practice the humanizing experience of being a young person or a student. So I come in and I tell them who I am. I normalize discussing pronouns as a thing that people should be asked, and I want to know about them, like, you know, and I attempt to normalize, you know, things about being an artist, about being a queer person. And I think that that's really important work, because sometimes people perceive that as some sort of like extraneous part of me, or like something that needs to be kept in a certain place, as if, you know, heteronormativity is the norm and also the accepted version of a way to be in the world. And that's just not true. And it's not helpful for young people when they're trying to figure out who they are, for people to be constantly presenting them with one option. So I like to bring in an expansiveness around gender. And then separately from the expansiveness around gender, an expansiveness around who you like, who you love, who, you know, you're attracted to. All of those things are very normal parts of the human experience, and pleasurable parts of the human experience. And children need to be invited into pleasure and joy.
Yeah. Some of your work lately has focused on cultivating supportive spaces for artists in Metro Detroit. Mm-hmm. And you and your partner, Backpack Durden, started this press called Paper Street, mm-hmm. that is a part of this. And Paper Street kind of started as a more virtual outing, but mm-hmm. it's taking some different directions. Can you talk about what you're doing and why you're doing this?
Absolutely. One, Paper Street is an invitation for artists to examine their process and focus less on the product. And in doing so, be invited into like the richness of that process, and celebrated for it. You know, like, it's so frequently that we're looking for products out of people. And that, unfortunately makes that person someone like of a consumable thing, and their work becomes consumable. And we're living in a world where we're just like, you know, churning out content all the time, and we're taking in content all the time. And so for me and for Backpack, when we were discussing things about the you know, the joys of being an artist and the making process and the wondering, and we're just hoping that we can shine a little bit of light and love on that part, is just being able to capture that. There's a lot of other intentions, but I think what one is also just consent. Like, when we're working with people, I try to be like, what do you want to make? Is this idea that I just talked about interesting? Or do you want to go off and make something that has really nothing to do with your practice, but you always have had a drive to make it and you want to put it into the world without having, you know, to like turn that back into like the work that everyone else knows you for. Yeah. So that's been a really beautiful journey to go on. I think that we're still very baby. We're very young.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of ideas, but, you know, Backpack and I are funding this on our own, and we both have very expansive practices of our own. So it is a project that's really coming from the heart, and it happens at the pace of trust, which means that a person could be working on something for 3 days or 4 years or, you know, whatever, and never possibly make anything. But it's really about the invitation to just do that and have people acknowledge that it's happening.
Could you just describe what the gatherings look like? Like what goes on when you're getting people together for Paper Street?
Sure. So we've been doing these gatherings that I'm calling sanctuary spaces. And, you know, we'll meet outside. There will be food, art supplies, and essentially like an invitation for people to just collaborate on something or work on something on their own, possibly with a prompt. And everything is paper-based. So while people are eating and talking and catching up, they can make a page that can go into a zine that will happen. That's going to be archived in a way. And then that will become a book. It's really rooted in how I truly believe that creativity is a part of healing, can be a huge tool for healing. And sometimes it's just about being given access to that.
Well, Syra Dardis, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for making a little time for us in your day.
Thank you. I really appreciate you.
Syra Dardis, artist working in Detroit and also one of the co-creators of Paper Street Press. Next up, two teachers talk to us about what's changed since they were queer teenagers.
There's more gay-straight alliances. There's definitely a lot more staff that are willing and open to acknowledge students by a different name or a different gender.
These experiences have fueled their work in the classroom. They'll explain how in just a minute. Don't go away. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you have any teachers in your life, or if you're one yourself, you know all about the need to decompress over summer. Sometimes there's a need for a different kind of decompression. Today, we've invited two public school teachers who are part of the LGBTQ community to join us. For decades in Michigan, it was not possible to be out and to teach. But today, both of our guests say that they're seeing more acceptance and also more recognition of the support that's needed for students who also identify as queer, trans, or non-binary. Kelly Boston is a school librarian in West Michigan. And Michelle DeYoung Foster just retired after 30 years teaching just outside Grand Rapids. Kelly, Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So before you were teachers, you were kids once upon a time with your own experiences as queer students. Michelle, were there teachers who helped you feel more comfortable being yourself?
I went to school in the 70s and the 80s, and there was no out to be. There was a drama teacher, you know, that everybody talked about. It was always just back talk and rumors and bullying. There was nobody I knew that was out. Even my great uncle, who served in World War II, he never was able to be out until he left his small town in Ohio and moved to Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Even in college, I can't say I knew a publicly out person, having graduated Adrian College in 1988. There was no comfort level and really no safety in being out during that time period.
Yeah. Kelly, what about you? What was your situation like?
Yeah, so I actually went to DeWitt Public Schools near Lansing, and, you know, I really hadn't figured out what my sexuality was at that point in time. But I was the kid that was, like, friends with every single queer kid. And everyone that, like, kind of knew you were a safe person came out to you. So I was just really involved, but I wasn't, like, in my own being yet. But I think compared to some of Michelle's experiences coming in a little bit later, I was able to benefit from some of the work that people had already started. We did have a GSA, which I was a part of, and that was huge in knowing, like, okay, there are teachers here that are okay with this. But I did see a lot of bullying. My best friend was gay and he wasn't out, but people could tell, and they would just constantly ask him if he was gay, ask me if he was gay. I watched him get bullied. I watched another friend have his parents kind of try to beat the gay out of him. So there was still definitely a lot going on, but I will say I did have one out teacher at the time, which was huge for me. And having that GSA group was a huge help as well.
So I guess, Michelle, you answered some of these questions, but are there challenges that the kids who are queer face today that are different than when you were students? Kelly, why don't you start this time?
I think that some of the bullying and some of the negative effects affect different parts of the LGBTQIA community differently. So like, for example, I have cis privilege because I identify with the gender I was assigned at birth and I look femme. So I kind of like match, so to speak. So I'm not as much of a target as other people might be. But I do think that we are seeing some differences in just how kids are reacting to each other. And part of me almost wants to give credit to TikTok, as much of a loaded kind of gun as that is, because I do think, I think part of it is just that so much of queer history or queer terminology has been hidden and kind of erased for so long. And now kids all of a sudden are seeing, like, seeing examples of this out in the world. And they're like, oh, because you can't be what you can't see, right? So I think that's made a difference. But I do think there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, it's occurred to me more than once that we now use words like transgender and we now use words like non-binary, whereas in the past, anyone who had a different gender identity or sexual identity was just sort of automatically assumed to be gay. Yeah.
Agreed.
Michelle, what about you? Do you see some different challenges for the young people these days?
Well, I think what I find real relieving is my generation kind of had to have our teenage years and our 20s. You came out when you left home. You came out when you went to college. And so you went through all those growing pains you would go through in your middle school and high school years of relationships and trying relationships out and trying your sexuality out in your 20s when it was costly. I mean, who was keeping the couch and who was keeping the cat, you know? Nowadays, it's really refreshing to hear parents talk about their kids and saying, well, she doesn't even really know what she's going to be yet. And I hate that. I'm like, did you realize how awesome that is? I'll reinforce, because she's doing it at a developmentally appropriate age, at age 16. And that's, I think, the wonderful part. There's definitely a lot more staff that are willing and open to acknowledge students by a different name or a different gender. That there's more safe places. I think that that's definitely the difference.
Yeah. Michelle, you just retired after 33 years of teaching. Want to make sure you get credit for
all... Get that extra three in there.
All that time.
They all count.
In the early days, you know, given when you came into the profession, when you were in the early days of your career, what was it like to be a gay teacher in public school?
What was really hard about being a gay teacher in the public schools was having to be deeply closeted. Witnessing students getting bullied, being able to be a teacher who cared about them and they knew cared about them and loved them no matter who they were, being a safe place but not openly gay. I could never come have that conversation with them to say, it'll get better. You know, that was so hard. And it really didn't start to change till around 2008. And I have to be honest, the first time when kids would say to me, well, you're married, or you're, I'd say yes. And I would use pronouns like they, or I would just say TK. You know, I would use things that were very gender neutral. And I hated playing the Artful Dodger all the time. But I could lose my job. I was threatened to lose my job. It was 30 years in the classroom before students asked me if I was married, and I bravely said, we had just legally been married, and I said, yes, I have a wife, and we have we've raised five kids, and she's put up with me nearly 25 years, and that was very liberating, terrifying, but liberating for me to actually say. At that point, I've kind of had that attitude like, you know, by saying it and acknowledging it, you know, what are they going to do, fire me? Okay, good. I can take my pension. It's 30 years.
Right. Did you feel like you had support from other teachers who might have been LGBT?
I was very blessed when I started teaching in 88 to meet a social worker who also had a partner, definitely a trailblazer. She and her partner had been together for at least 16 years. Her partner was also a teacher in a public school system just south of where I worked. And again, deeply closeted, but you only really met people through the grapevine. And it was nice to have a safe place, a safe person. You know, in 95, when my wife and I had a commitment ceremony, I maybe had three people I was out to in the building. That were my trusted allies, and had our commitment ceremony. And just then the Jerry Crane incident occurred two exits up from me, where in Grand Rapids, this poor guy was a beloved teacher, was run out of town on the rails by administration at a local church there. And 6 months later, purportedly, he died of a heart attack due to the stress. And then there was an ongoing, you know, could his partner get his, you know, accidental death insurance policy because they weren't legally married? And that shot me right directly into the closet even deeper in 95.
My guests today, if you're just joining us, are Michelle DeYoung Foster, a retired teacher with 33 years experience in Western Michigan, and Kelly Boston, a middle school librarian in West Michigan. Kelly, when you listen to Michelle talk about these experiences from her career, how does that compare with what things are like for you on the job?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought is like, wow, I'm so grateful for people like her who have paved the way for people like me. For me, I'm going into my, what did I just finish, my eighth year. That last one was kind of hard to keep track of.
Right.
I know, like, what happened? COVID. And my experience has definitely shown some progress from that, but I still, even doing this interview, I was anxious because I am still employed in a Michigan school district. Starting out when I proposed to my wife, I remember Michelle was one of my safe people at school. So, and I knew if she was out, at least to me. So I remember sitting in her classroom being like, oh my gosh, I think I'm going to marry this woman. And what do I do? And do I have to tell people? Or you almost feel like in education, you're put on such a pedestal. And I think I remember going through college and being told things like, even if you're not married, wear a wedding ring, and just all of these cautionary tales. And then to be queer on top of it and to worry about, you know, you imagine these things in your head of like this angry mob of people that are going to come get you if they find out, you know, that you're being queer and you're teaching their children. I still, like, little things that I get jealous of, like, other teachers have pictures of their families up in their room, and I debate, like, is it okay to have this on my desk? Or, you know, at the beginning of the year, they show the slideshow, because that's a huge part of building relationships with kids, is being able to be your whole self. I started in a new school district, and that was one thing. I wanted to wait until I got the job because my wife is also a teacher, and she had gone through applying for a series of jobs, and she was very straightforward, and she came out in her interviews because she just wanted to be who she was, and she did not get any of those jobs until I said, you know what, try not coming out in the interview and see what happens, and she got the next job she applied for. So,
oh, wow.
So that really stuck with me. So I waited until they wanted me. And then I had a conversation with my now administrator, and I said, look, like, this is who I am. I want to be able to put my picture out with my wife on my desk. I want to be able to answer the kids honestly, because I think that's so important for them to see examples of adults who are out there living their lives authentically. So it's still anxiety inducing. It's still something I think about often. But I think that I'm kind of, you know, I'm riding on the coattails of folks like Michelle and able to reap the benefits of some of that progress. So I'm very, very grateful for that.
Kelly, you said something about being your whole self as you're building a rapport with kids. And I've got to believe that that has taken on even more weight over the past 18 months. When I'm not exactly sure what things were like in your district, but there were a lot of teachers interacting with kids over the internet over the past year and a half of traditional schooling. I mean, I know you're in a library situation, but I know librarians were also interacting with kids, even if they were at a distance. What was the past year like?
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird year, April. You know, when I was at my previous district, that whole rest of the year was just so mind-boggling because we got sent home, didn't know when we were coming back, and we were remote the rest of that time. It was just this reeling of, like, we have to adapt. We have to build this plane as we're flying it. So we, you know, figuring out ways to reach kids. I don't think that it necessarily changed the way I interacted with them. But luckily at my new school district, we were actually able to be in person for almost all of this school year, aside from 3 weeks. So that was huge.
That's great.
Being in person makes such a difference.
Did you see, or did either of you hear any stories anecdotally of what was going on with queer students during this time?
I was kind of brought in as a guest speaker because I did an inclusive libraries presentation through MCLS, and a school had reached out to me and asked me to speak with their GSA while we were all remote. So I thought that was really awesome. Their GSA club was still meeting remotely, so I got to Google Meet in and talk to the kids, and they came in from home. I think it was a little bit trickier because, unfortunately for some kids, they don't have supportive parents at home, or it may not even be safe for them to be out to their families. When we're able to do a GSA at school, it's a lot easier. So I think it did limit a lot what you could do with the GSA and the kids that you could reach in that safe space.
Well, it's good to hear, Kelly, that you've been a part of that. I was wondering, while it was not possible for either of you to be as fully out as you might have preferred during this time, there are districts in Michigan where teachers, principals, and students are openly out and supported. I want to ask both of you what you hope for the kids and the teachers who will follow after you. Kelly, do you mind going first?
You know, I have to say, I have this group of students this year that I just adored. They kind of got together and they created a Google Doc and collaborated. I was so proud. And they wrote a letter to our administrators in the building, and they asked politely and worded it really beautifully if they could decorate for Pride Month. And they kind of came to me and had me help them proofread it. And it was really cool because the administrators were supportive, and I also had them decorate the library, and they were like, can we make posters? And they like made themselves their own research project. So they're like making posters about how, you know, gender is a social construct, or like Girl in Red, who's a lesbian musician, or different things, because so much of that gets left out of the curriculum. Yeah.
Wow.
And they were able to like make rainbow chains to hang around the library and things. And I was so nervous just as a queer educator, because I think the fear is that, like, I don't want parents to think I'm in here like spreading the gay agenda, because we know that's not a real thing, but that's the fear. It's not contagious. I'm just seeing kids for who they are. But I think seeing that those kids just come together and be so passionate and do this on their own, and they're educating their peers, and just to be able to really support the student-led movement gives me so much hope for the future, because they're already doing a lot of this. Like, it's really cool to be here and be supportive, and they can come to me and we can chat, or, you know, I have an administrator now who... We had a student who came into the district from another district and was struggling with their gender identity. And my administrator called me up and said, hey, Kelly, you know, since you're part of this community, are you willing to be a mentor for this kid, or can they come talk to you if they're having a hard time? And just to have it seen as an asset where I'm at, and as a way I can relate to students instead of being something that detracts from me being a part of this district, it makes me feel really seen. So even within this last year, I've just been given a lot of hope by seeing kind of where we're headed. It's given me a lot of hope.
Michelle, what about you?
I echo everything that Kelly said. It's wonderful that students can have this experience. And in the relatively rural district that I just retired from, it's much more sophisticated than it was when I first came in terms of diversity. But not incredibly diverse. But I think there's a lot more diversity sexually than there is racially in our district. And anything that can help students be their true authentic self earlier, so that they don't deal with the social emotional issues. So many of our young students, I have to give a shout out to our high school, who I think does a beautiful job of supporting our students. Whereas in my middle school setting, it's still just not 100% a wonderful place to be yet, because I don't think people take them seriously when they're experiencing things in middle school. You know, it's puppy love, kind of going way back
right.
to a bad example. But it gives me a ton of hope. It gives me a ton of hope. I'm a little more fearful after probably the last 4-year cycle we had. I think we went backwards. I think a lot of people were given a lot of energy to speak their intolerance very loudly. And I think whereas people were more tolerant before, I'm a little worried we've got some work to do. I don't think that the headwinds are not in our direction to make anything go deeply back in the closet ever again. And that gives me good hope.
Michelle DeYoung Foster has retired after 33 years teaching in West Michigan. And Kelly Boston is a middle school librarian. She lives in West Michigan, too. Kelly, Michelle, it is such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for making a couple minutes with us.
Thanks, April.
Thank you so much.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again with you tomorrow.